you say the U.S. Sherpa is part of the talk. So, in fact, the U.S. is participating in the preparations for the G20 in November.
The spring meetings took place 2 weeks ago, and there the most senior people from the U.S. Treasury were participating and also from the Fed. South Africa came in for special attention, mostly because of the advocacy interest groups in South Africa. And that individuals have some kind of proximity to President Trump from South Africa who have been linked to
South Africa. AfriForum, etc. America at the time and its 15 attacks on South Africa just this year alone might drive a bus through that G20 process. How are you feeling about the G20? Zain Dangor is our G20 Sherpa. He's the Director General of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. He's also my friend from school and in the area we grew up together. So very welcome and thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Peril. And it's really a great honor and a privilege to be on your show.
So I wanted to start with watching you at the International Court of Justice last week and then tracking back to your history as an activist and as an activist against apartheid through many, many years, in fact, decades, coming from a family of activists. Your sister, of course, the late Jessie Duarte, Ahmad Dangor, the novelist and somebody who used their literature as resistance, Mohammed Dangor, an entire family. Do you think that that history propelled you to the ICJ? Is there a golden thread that could be drawn as we watched you at the International Court of Justice last week, making a second argument against Israel and what was happening in the occupied territories of Palestine?
Thank you, Ferry. So maybe the first part of the question is, you know, and I was thinking about it quite often is, you know, why are some people propelled to be engaged with issues of justice and freedom and equality and others not? And I think there is also, and you would be an example of that as well, given your own background. Often I feel that we didn't even have a choice. The issue of justice and equality was something that was demanded of us as even as young people, even as children, you know, for example, getting an instruction from your family as a 6-year-old as you're going to school, not to sing the anthem, which was the apartheid anthem, even though you know you're going to be punished at school by some of the teachers. But you also knew that it was worth it. It was part of a bigger cause. So the history of fighting for equality and justice and that solidarity was one, it was sort of ingrained in a family and community culture. So appearing at the court and the processes to getting there is part of a continuum that I think, you know, you choose to be part of then. You sort of, there's a shaping and there's a conscientious raising and there's a cultural development that happens, but there's also a conscious choice that one makes, the track that you'll take in life. And for me, it was, like many others before me, is a choice to use whatever platforms we have to push for justice and equality. So it was an honor, a real honor for me to be part of a team to represent South Africa at the ICJ. You know, South Africa was one of 45 countries this time around, engaging with a request from the UN about whether Israel was breaching its obligations as an occupying power, but also as a member of the UN in relation to international humanitarian law. But for us, again, it's about justice, equality, and sometimes this comes at a cost. But it was a real honor to be part of a government, part of a team that put its best foot forward to fight for, not for ourselves directly, but to fight for humanity. I think Daniel Levy, who was a former negotiator for Israel, just, you know, encapsulated it in one word. It says, what we are doing as South Africa and others is fighting for our common humanity.
And so I watched all of you there and kept a close eye on that case. And then every single night, you see images out of Gaza, which shows, I was thinking, you can't pummel this place any longer. And yet that is exactly what's being done. So why is it important when you see this destruction happening? It almost feels moot to bring a case like that. Why is it important to continue this case, which is likely to go on for, I think, another 8 years? And it is the case that has put the country in the crosshairs of the US, if you read quite deeply into the demands being made of South Africa.
So Africa's taken the genocide case to the ICJ. And that we did in 2023. And we did that cognizant of our obligations under the Genocide Convention. You know, the key thing about the convention is not to punish genocide as much as to prevent genocide. So what you're having is an unfolding genocide. You know, and as many UN report last week even stated that this genocide is unfolding in front of the eyes of the world, and the world is perhaps standing passively. So we've taken the responsibility to seek to prevent more deaths, but we also see that Israel continues to disregard the injunctions of this court as they are disregarding the injunctions and obligations that arise out of, you know, resolutions of the Security Council. But let's also look at what has happened since then. So we took its stance in December 2023, but in 2024, there was also a resolution on the legality of the occupation that came through the UN, that was deliberated at the ICJ, that was overwhelmingly supported by the global community. Then you also had another resolution initiated by Norway about Israel's responsibility as an occupying power in, you know, in response to the people that they occupy, which is the case that we heard last week. So you can see that there's a momentum growing to hold Israel and other powerful nations to account in the institutions meant to hold them account. And part of why South Africa gets some kind of pressure from some of the more powerful is that, you know, we used to be called the international legal subalterns. We were the subjects of international law. We were not supposed to take international law and hold those who breach these laws accountable, especially the most powerful.
So that inversion of power, you've said, comes at cost. Will you paint for us what some of those costs have been for people and for also for the country?
Look, I think the cost has really been the kind of attention we're getting, really misinformation from some in the US, and it's not necessarily the administration. You know, the previous administration may have disagreed with what we're doing, but they really supported the fact that we took this initiative to the institutions meant to adjudicate on it. We had the disagreements. I could meet with my counterparts and have engagements about the meaning and relative importance of international law. And there was a respect, I think, at some point, even begrudgingly, for the fact that South Africa took these actions. And that's the pressure. But the flip side of this is also important, that South Africa's, you know, stature, and it's not just the once-off. I think if you look at our actions in the international community since about 2018, was to be more consistent on international law, more consistent on the application of our human rights obligations. And that has created an appreciation and respect for the role that we're playing as a middle power on the tip of the southern continent, to use the institutions to the fullest extent. We don't have a big economy where we can use coercive measures. We don't have an army to use the threat of force. We're essentially saying we're using the institutions of global governance to build peace. So we actually have more respect than pressure. The pressure is coming from some one or two of the most powerful countries in the world, but generally in the international community, wherever we go, there's a huge respect and appreciation for the role we've played, with some saying nobody else could have done this other than you, and you've given us the courage to do exactly the same.
You could very clearly see that with Ireland, with Norway now, with many other countries who joined the case last week. So as we shape this diplomacy of Ubuntu, I think you've called it, how do you answer the critique that we are uneven in our solidarity. So we're uneven in that we may not be as vociferous for the people of Sudan. And then the one that always comes up is that we are not as vociferous in our solidarity with the people of Ukraine, although that may have changed with the short visit by the leader of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, 2 weeks ago.
So let's start with the second one with Ukraine. So the visit by the president of Ukraine was 2 years in the making. Right. And it wasn't a decision that was made, you know, a month or two before his visit. It was really trying to get him and our president to meet, but on South African soil. And the reason why the Ukrainians felt it was important for this to happen and that South Africa felt it was important to happen is, and it, you could hear, you know, the Ukrainian president in his press statement echoing this. There's various peace initiatives. The Africa Peace Initiative, which South Africa, our president sort of kickstarted with other heads of states. There's the initiative that Brazil, China, and other like-minded countries started. And then there's what is called the Zelensky Peace Plan, which is essentially a peace process led by the Ukrainians. So we've been involved in all three. In the Zelensky Peace Plan, we have been the most consistent participant, but also the most consistent participant at a senior level, because we felt that it was critically important to ensure that our voices are heard and that we help shape the process that could lead to a dialogue. So the principles that was agreed to in Copenhagen already in, I think, beginning of 2023, when the very first meeting took place, South Africa helped shape those principles. And these principles are very important. It is underpinned by the UN Charter that says you can have no acquisition of land through the use of force, which was a very clear message to all, including the Russians and others, that we would not recognize the annexation of land or the acquisition of land that is taken through the use of force, whether that's Crimea or the Donbas, and the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine needed to be respected. That framing was then taken into the G20 in India and then also in Brazil. So we played a major role in shaping the kind of norms around which a just peace would be negotiated. So our consistency has always been appreciated by most people in the outside world, but not as much in the South African context.
And why do you think that is?
It's part of these things that we speak about and these things that we don't. And oftentimes, you know, it could be maybe the approach that we take in a public diplomacy. But, you know, we were at pains to point out, for example, that while we may have abstained on some of the resolutions in the UN on Russia, our explanations about were very clear that we would want the resolutions to preface peace rather than more war. But at the same time, we made it very clear that the use of force by Russia was unlawful, and we made it very clear in our messaging. We would argue that while we may have an understanding and appreciation for some of the security concerns they put forward, there was no imminent threat by Ukraine, there was no invasion by Ukraine, and therefore the use of force was unlawful. And that we said from the very first statement in the UN.
Maybe we didn't read it closely enough, but I wonder, is someone like the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, who's a very close friend of South Africa's, when he comes here, you can see he's at ease and it feels quite chummy. I wonder if they have heard that message clearly enough from South Africa.
They have. I think that when we negotiated the language in India at the G20, myself and the Brazilian Sherpa, who were crafting this language and negotiating it with the other delegations, we met with Minister Lavrov and we explained to him where it comes from, why it's important for South Africa and Brazil, that it's rooted in the Charter. And he agreed. He said, if that's Charter language, international law language, we will not oppose it. And I think it's important that we point this out because it provides the framework and parameters around what we mean by a just peace. We did put this out in the South African media, but for some reason or the other, it just did not get traction. It wasn't the framing that people wanted. The last resolution where we voted yes, which was this year, was because finally we had a resolution that was as close to one that we would have drafted ourselves. So ironically, the zero draft was the US, where they pushed the language of unconditional ceasefire and peace, which is the language we've been using and wanting for a long time. But then they deleted the just component of it, which means that the just components would then frame the sovereignty issue, the no acquisition of land through the use of force, and also the inclusive nature of the peace processes. The French delegation on behalf of the EU put that in place. And when that was on the table, we supported the resolution and we could vote for it.
That's really interesting to get that background.
Essentially, it was all the elements that we had wanted for 3 years.
That's really interesting.
And Sudan, I think, you know, we Sudan is one of the greatest humanitarian crises. We have teams that are trying to work. This is not the kind of, you know, engagement that we would be doing by standing on, you know, on the highest platforms, because it's not that kind of conflict or war. But we are engaging with all the belligerents in this case to get a ceasefire. But we also point out, Cyril, that what we must also do is not create the kind of conditions for this to flare up again. We need a permanent solution. What you have in Sudan is a situation where you've got a military that deposed the civilian government, fighting with a breakaway, essentially, from it. Our view is that we are working to ensure that the civilian voices become stronger, that you actually create the conditions for a civilian government to take over, so that you don't create a short-term peace between belligerents that have been at this since at least the early 2012 onwards. And you will have cycles of this violence because we leave out the justice component from the peace. You know, when the currency is extreme violence, peace at all costs then becomes the option, and peace at all costs without dealing with the issue of justice just means that you lay the basis for the next iteration of atrocities to occur.
And so with Palestine, you have a tension. With Ukraine, I'd argue maybe hope. Mm-hmm. Where do you see things in Sudan? Because it just seems to be escalating every time you look, with almost no end in sight to even talks about talks.
Yeah. So with Sudan, we need to get them to, the first port of call is to stop the killing, to get a ceasefire. And then based on that ceasefire, to work towards a process that will ensure that this does not happen again. So we're working through the AU, we're working through the institutions in the Great Lakes regions that is also working on this. It's a protracted conflict. It's not complex. It's really just, you know, one of the areas on our continent where, as I've pointed out, we've allowed those who use violence as their currency to continue to benefit because we negotiate short-term deals for interim pieces without, you know, holding them accountable for their actions. And that's where the justice component is so important. And we support the ICC investigating all of these actors so that you deal with impunity. Because if we don't deal with impunity, then we're basically giving the tacit go-ahead for this to happen again. So we are working with the UN. It's on the UN's radar, with the AU. And we're also working with teams of negotiators to bring these parties towards a ceasefire. But it's not the sexy issue. It's you know, and this is the sadness of it. It doesn't get the attention that it should get.
No, it doesn't. Absolutely. And from us as well as the media. I do want to move on to the G20 because it's a huge G20 year for us. And when I attended the foreign ministers meeting, I did feel a little bit like America at the time and its 15 attacks on South Africa just this year alone might drive a bus through that G20 process. How are things going? Because whenever I look at my WhatsApp, there are meetings going on, but I want to catch up with you on how you think the big picture is. Are we still going to have a G20?
Yes. I mean, we're working towards our leaders' summit in November. We've concluded over 42 meetings now of the 130 that we'll have before the end of the year. And this week, there's a lot of, you know, second meetings of all the working groups, and there'll be a third meetings in May, towards the end of May. So in terms of our agenda and our plan, things are continuing apace. You know, we've had good engagements with the U.S. Sherpa. Subsequent to the very first foreign minister's meeting, the U.S. Sherpa participated in an online Sherpa meeting. But we are confident that we will get a document that the leaders will be able to engage with, but also leads to implementation. You know, we're the last developing country that is the president of the G20. The agenda for Africa and the developing countries may lose focus once, you know, the new cycle continues with the U.S. taking over the presidency next year. So we do see there's a special responsibility to ensure the agreements that have been taken from India, Indonesia, and Brazil are shaped towards implementation, no longer just the leaders' declaration, but how do we start implementing, you know, debt relief issues? How do we start implementing, you know, a situation where there is reform of the international multilateral lending institutions so that we do deal with the inequities in accessing debt?
So I just want to dial back a bit. You say the U.S. Sherpa is part of the talk. So, in fact, the U.S. is participating in the preparations for the G20 in November.
Yes, in the key meetings, like the Sherpa meetings, the Sherpa has been participating, and the Sherpa is in the White House. That also follows a meeting that myself and the Brazilian Sherpa had with him in D.C. The spring meetings took place 2 weeks ago, and that's the second finance ministers meeting took place. And there, the most senior people from the U.S. Treasury were participating, and also from the U.S. Fed were participating.
Isn't that really important thing to know?
It is, and I think, you know, the finance drug lead did outline that this was the level of participation. The governor of the Reserve Bank also made a brief statement towards that. So it is important. You will find some of the working group meetings where the State Department plays a role. So you've got different players. You've got the White House. You've got where the Sherpa is located. You've got the Treasury and the Fed. But you also have the State Department. And the State Department, we will see more unequal participation because the State Department is, you know, under the Secretary of State, may not authorize all the participation in the working groups. But at the Sherpa level, there's participation at the level of the Treasury and the Reserve Bank of the U.S. There's full participation at this stage. That may change, but for now, the U.S. is participating.
It's really interesting. Let's get back to some of the substantive discussions. I see by the end of August, there will be a position paper on African debt, which is one of the big issues of the G20, the reform of the international architecture, of the Security Council, but also of the other multilateral institutions. How hopeful are you that you'll see substantive progress made by the time the baton is passed to the US in November?
So our instruction from our cabinet, but also from the other members of the G20, is to be ambitious. That what we cannot have is at the end of the cycle to have a set of outcomes that are diluted so that we, you know, so that we get a consensus. And we don't want a consensus that is based on the lowest common denominator. We want to have a consensus, but a consensus based on a set of ambitious outcomes. So we are going to work towards that. It may mean that we don't have the agreement of all 21 members of the G20. We may need a formula that was arrived at during the Italian presidency, for example, which was during President Trump's first term, where you had a 19+1 approach, which was essentially not consensus, but it, in our language, we'd use sufficient consensus. It was the kind of consensus that reflected what the will of the majority was, with an explanation of what the dissenting voices wanted and could not get, and respecting that dissent, but allowing for a majority perspective to emerge. So we've raised this as a modality for work. because we do want a concrete outcome in August, for example, by the panel led by former Minister Manuel that will deal with some of the barriers to inclusive growth in Africa, which includes the cost of capital and other barriers that his team will be working on. So we're hoping that that ambition will be reflected in the Leaders' Summit. Similarly, with the issues of inequality, we're hoping that that ambition from one of our task force will be reflected in the Leaders' Summit. And where necessary, we will then get a formula for a leaders' agreement that, if we cannot accommodate all, will be ambitious, but will also reflect that there is a minority position that has emerged. It's not ideal, but it's been done before. Yeah.
So that would be a likely outcome, and it would be a good outcome at this point.
Yes, it's likely, and it will still be a good outcome. You know, because there's a level of, as the Sherpas were at points to stress in the last Sherpa meeting, what we need is a continuum. If you have a sharp break, for example, in the kinds of agreements that you've had since even Italy, you know, the Italian presidency emerged during COVID. And, you know, the COVID period emphasized the need for solidarity, the need for working together. And then that continued right up until last year. And we're taking that forward with our themes. There's a fear that if that continuity is broken, implementation becomes difficult, because you will probably require two or three more presidencies just to rebuild what has been lost, and implementation will then be on the back burner.
It'll be a feat of negotiation to see that achieved. But it does feel to me like there's a softening in the US-South Africa relationship. Maybe I'm just counting that there hasn't been drastic growth in my Trump tracker, which is a note I keep of all the posts, the executive orders, the coming legislation. Am I correct in seeing this kind of softening in attitude and the opening at least to talks between the two countries?
So it's always important to just contextualize what's happening at the moment. So the US administration, based on an election platform that they've had, is embarking on changing what they feel is necessary for that agenda. You know, if you look at the agenda, you know, the plan that they put forth through the Heritage Foundation before that, they're actually implementing that. So South Africa is not alone in having to deal with this. The entire world is having to deal with this. South Africa came in for special attention mostly because of the advocacy of interest groups in South Africa, and that they have some kind of proximity. Individuals have some kind of proximity to President Trump from South Africa, who have been linked to South
Africa. We're talking AfriForum, et cetera.
Well, AfriForum at the domestic level and solidarity at the domestic level. Then you've also have, you know, the, you know, Elon Musk, and then you've got the what is called the PayPal grouping. A lot of them are former South Africans or people with a link to South Africa, but quite influential and all billionaires. So that is why South Africa would have been getting a slightly more specialized attention than, say, Brazil would have been getting. But overall, the policy thrusts are for everybody. So when we engage with the US, it's about what does the change in approach to multilateral engagement mean? What is the approach to solidarity-based partnerships mean? For example, the aid funding for HIV and others is a global issue. You know, the cutting of US aid funds is not a South African issue, it's a global issue. So we engage on the global and also the specificities around our own relationship. And that dialogue has been quite fruitful, because we dialogue quite respectfully, you know, with our interlocutors, and we're getting, you know, and as they are building up, you know, the capacities in the State Department, we're finding the voices that we need to be talking to now. So there is a thawing, but that thawing, as we went to Washington, we stressed that agreement requires engagement, because we might have different views. But if we're going to get to some form of agreement or accommodation, we need the kind of engagement that is not golf diplomacy. It's actually, you know, officials and experts sitting down understanding what's the nature of the world, what's changing, where do we agree, where do we disagree, how do we navigate within that space. And that's happening.
Is that possible? And is it beginning to happen? Because the last time we spoke, or I spoke to people at Derco, there weren't even counterparts in the state, in the US State Department, with whom they could begin the normal channels of diplomacy. It was all happening at the PayPal level, the golf course, etc.
So there's been people that's been appointed in acting positions in the national security architecture, which we've met with. At good meetings, there's people in the State Department that have been called to act in the senior positions. And you're quite right. I mean, the normal cohort is not there, but they are building up to teams that we now can be working with and on a very recognized and defined level. You know, we host a meeting called WGAGI every year between the U.S.
What is that?
A working group. It's a working group on Africa and global initiatives, South Africa and the U.S. And we, you know, so it used to be myself and Victoria Nuland used to co-chair this meeting. We will co-chair again with the acting head. And it's our turn to host this year. And they've indicated that they're willing to participate. And we're trying to pull it forward. We normally have these meetings just before the General Assembly in September. But that's the meeting.
So that's an important one to watch.
And we do deep dives. You know, it's behind closed doors. We'll do a readout of what the meeting was, but a lot of what we've discussed is really for implementation on security issues. You know, these are the kind of meetings, for example, where South Africa and the US would have collaborated on the Ethiopian peace talks in the last 3 or 4 years, on how do we deal with Great Lakes in a particular way? How do we iron out our differences on processes to peace in Ukraine? How do we deal with Middle East issues? You know, we don't deal with them in a very public manner, but we really deal with it from an expert perspective, even knowing that in the political space, there may be disagreements. We're hoping to get back to that.
And when will this working group meeting happen, do you think?
So it's normally in September. We've asked for dates so that this could happen before then. So hopefully we'll get the dates.
Do you think the US President Donald Trump will attend the G20 in November, or is it too early to say?
It's too early to say. I think things happen so fast and that it's too early to say at this stage. You know, the U.S. is the part of the Troika, so it's Brazil, South Africa, and the U.S., and we would need to hand over to the U.S., so we're hoping that at that level they will participate at the most senior level available so that we could do a proper handover.
My next question isn't a who, it's a process question. How far are we in beginning the process to appoint a new ambassador to the US? And I've also heard that the envoy, Mkhabisi Jonas, actually did manage to get a call with the US President Donald Trump. And I wonder if you're at all at liberty to say how that went.
So the president has had a call with President Trump. So that, you know, that's been in the public domain. I think that the envoy is engaging with his counterpart envoys. And, you know, so I'm not at liberty to say what the outcomes of that is at this stage yet. You know,
an ambassador appointment?
What we're focusing on right now is just to get the envoy to work with a team to ensure that the envoy engages with a range of stakeholders in the White House, in academia, in civil society, other key players on the Hill. While that happens, we can then, you know, let the president go through the processes of deciding what, you know, who will be the ambassador in D.C. Following the processes that the president, you know, would be choosing to follow in this rather unique space that we are in.
And I do thank you for that. I do want to talk a little bit as we get to the end of our interview about this idea of the rise of the middle powers. And I find it quite a persuasive one, which I've been trying to deep read on. Do you place us among these middle powers? And do you think that you can see them emerging as almost as a block? Or is that really just the BRICS plus block?
Look, there's been a lot more discussions amongst, you know, middle powers, you know. When I went to Europe, there was a keen interest in how do we collaborate beyond existing blocks? How do we collaborate as middle powers across blocks? because it's middle powers that actually require framework in the global space that is predictable, that is stable. Because, you know, and as I said earlier on, middle powers generally bring normative issues to the equation. We don't bring big armies, and we don't use coercive measures, economic measures. We tend to argue what is right, what is wrong. How do we deal with the injustices of what is wrong? How do we amplify what is right and collaborate together? So we require, for example, international law to be respected. And that's where the discussion is, you know, is how do we begin to work together, whether it's Norway, Ireland, Turkey. We've just had this discussion with Turkey last week in The Hague. How do we continue to build momentum for middle powers to work together across the blocks that we find ourselves in due to history or geography? And
so are those trade agreements like we saw with the EU summit? That was huge and it went under the radar a little bit. Yeah. Is this the kind of world that you see shaping as America prosecutes a very aggressive set of trade disputes around the world?
It's that's the kind of world where, you know, the partnerships that we're all looking to build must be predictable. It must be consistent. You know, elections will happen in countries and we all expect elections to happen in democracies. But the outcomes of those elections, we are hoping, doesn't change the manner in which engagement takes place significantly. And the, you know, irrespective of who takes the reins of political power, if the normative framework is one that country X, country Y would be respecting, for example, the importance of working through the WTO and the rules of the WTO, even though we must reform it, or working through the UN, even though we must reform it, that is what's pulling together, you know, the individual countries in the European Union, working with South Africa. And we've also just seen the EU, because the EU is a powerful bloc jointly. But if you break them down, they're all essentially middle powers. And the same in Latin America, same in Asia. You know, Qatar, for example, as early as 2022, we were talking about with Qatar, how do we begin to use our platforms to engage, to pull people together for mediation? You know, so we've got mediation agreements with Norway and partnerships. And we do have the same now with Qatar and others, not in a formal sense like we have with Norway, but in an informal basis. Because we do see that different middle powers will be able to convene different groupings depending on where they are on particular issues. So it's really about collaboration, partnerships, and not necessarily only around trade, but it's also about how we shape the world to be one that is more peaceful, more just. And middle powers are perhaps the best vehicle to do that.
So it seems like the middle powers are going to shape this G20 in ways that perhaps hadn't been that clear at the beginning of the year.
Yes. So if you look at the G20, it's got a lot of powerful countries, but you also have both in terms of permanent members and guest members, a lot of them are middle powers. And, you know, if you listen to the statements emerging from Ireland's and Australia's, and South Africa, there's a lot of similarities on the issues that we want to see in the world. And they will work with us to shape the outcome.
I want to go to a linked question. I was really interested, impressed, surprised at the communique out of Doha last week that it had managed to put meat on the bones of what might just be a substantive peace deal between Rwanda and the DRC. And I wondered why that wasn't happening on our continent and why South Africa hadn't perhaps been more ambitious in locating itself into finding peace to what is another of the intractable and really large festering wars on our continent.
So I think in this case, Doha was just the space where the meeting took place. The long term, and it wasn't, you know, even the Qataris will explain that it's not a replacement for the substantive talks and negotiations, which is led by African countries. You know, the Luanda process is still leading this. And that's an AU-led process. So that is why the South Africans and the AU welcomed what is emerging in Doha, because it's building on from what's happening on the continent. Sometimes it becomes a lot more difficult when the conditions are that one or two of the players would see South Africa or SADC or as being unhelpful. And we're always very cognizant of how we must best work with others to build peace. So we welcome what has happened in Qatar. What we also hope will emerge from this is one that builds on a lasting peace, that deals with the various players in the eastern part of the DRC. It's not just M23. There are other armed groups that must be brought into the equation. And there's a lot of work happening outside of the radar of the media. And, you know, I'm not going to even be able to speak to this here, but there's a lot of work that's happening with the other groupings to bring people closer to peace and long-term peace, and so that you don't have an agreement that is short-lived and then flares up again. We welcome and we work with the Qataris and others, but we also emphasize that the Luanda process in place, it is the one that continues to lead the negotiations. Of course, there was some irritations emerging in that Rwanda, for example, was unhappy with the sanctions that was levied on them by the European Union, you know, following the attacks on the SADC troops, and sanctions was placed on their mining head and also some generals. You know, we've engaged on this for a while, is that we cannot have a situation where a mineral deal becomes part of this process with a country that does not have the minerals. Because what you're then laying the basis for is continued conflict around the exploitation of that mineral. And unless that is part of the deal in a concrete way that will allow for the minerals to benefit the people of the DRC and the region, and it doesn't become part of what we are working with others on, you know, just like we're working on, we worked on blood diamonds, we're also working on how do we have a global appreciation for the need for supply chains to be free of blood in the mineral space as well.
That's so true. It's a time of transactional diplomacy.
Yeah. And that's the thing about transactional diplomacy, is that it becomes expedient. It becomes one where principle is foregone, and it lays the basis for continuation of conflict. Because people, you know, if the basis of this is not based on issues of what has contributed to this conflict, what are the governance issues that are at play, what are the ethnic issues that may have to be addressed substantively, the root cause issues have to be addressed. It cannot just be, you know, as the Ukrainians have said, we cannot make deals, we need to build peace. And this is where, you know, we will have to be very careful in evaluating what emerges from quick fix solutions that is transactional.
That's fair. Thank you. My final question to you is, the G20 can often feel like a set of meetings happening at a very high level, and that ordinary people can't be involved with it. And I've been asked many times by people, how can we be involved? How do we get access to all these exciting meetings as the momentum begins to build now? And there's still, I think, 80 meetings left, and then obviously the big ones. How do ordinary people get involved? Does Brazil offer us any examples of what we should look out for this year?
So the one way in which people can get involved in, but unfortunately sometimes even there's bureaucracies in civil society as well, right? So, but you've got the Civil Society 20, and we've just hopefully managing to get them to work together. The perennial South African issue is who is the legitimate voice of civil society has been at play, and we're working to resolve that. You've got the B20 where business people can participate, but the T20 as well, the women 20.
What's the T20?
It's the think tank 20, which is your universities, and they advertising their meetings quite well and openly, and maybe we can just amplify that through DERCO as well. You know, it's not the government led. We don't set them up. We can just intervene where there's conflicts, but they're essentially autonomous. But it's the space for ordinary people, think tanks, organizations to be engaged in. There was a discussion on whether we need a media 20. And that might be something for future presidencies to engage with. Some really good, you know, media advocates in South Africa have, you know, sort of flown this balloon when we're engaging with whether that would be useful, because it could be useful to look at, in a world where disinformation becomes the norm, whether a media 20 would not be important, you know, as a means to developing the kind of standards that the G20 would want to see around responsible reporting or just freedom of expression, those kind of issues.
But vital in a world of disinformation. Yeah,
yeah. Absolutely. You know, so there are people that we've been having discussions with on how to make this happen. But unfortunately, we can't do it in our presidency. It will be something that the US presidency or the...
Well, I'm not hopeful about that.
The UK and South Korea in that order may want to take forward. And perhaps for the UK, that's something we can engage further with. But there are various avenues for participation. But we will also be having a summit before the Leaders Summit, a G20 civil summit, where the C20 and others will be convening a huge summit of civil society. And hopefully the space will be there for ordinary, you know, people to participate. And you normally participate through institutions, organizations.
Thank you. So our time is up. I want one word from you on how you're feeling about the G20.
Look, I'm feeling optimistic about the work that we're doing. You know, the organization is great. We've got great leadership from the other departments on the working groups. You know, the finance track is being well led. So I do think that our issues are being put on the agenda. We're leading and facilitating the discussions in a manner that is being appreciated by the other members of the G20, and they've expressed that. So I do think that we're feeling optimistic about...
That's a good word. You know,
we may not have full consensus, but we will have a good outcome.
Thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Vera.